The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, The Hidden Cost of Offshoring. A little-known federal government program is spending almost $800 million annually to assist U.S. workers who lose their jobs to offshoring. And the actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, U.S. spends millions to aid workers when jobs leave. Quietly, North Carolinians using little-known program in higher numbers. And this article is written by Lauren Onisorge. After 25 years with the same company in Morrisville, Wake Forest's Robert Wildrick thought he was on the road to retirement. But that was until Teleflex, like a handful of other Triangle employers, took advantage of stealthy tax breaks almost 4,000 miles away. For employees such as Wildrick, who lost his job in 2016, corporate offshoring can come as a shock. I had made a living outsourcing America, he recalls. Then it was, well, what goes around comes around. But thanks to a little-known government program with a budget of $790 million, it's actually to Wildrick's benefit to have his job offshored instead of just eliminated. That's because it entitles him to Trade Adjustment Assistance, TAA, the Cadillac of unemployment services, officials say. And with the companies continuing to take advantage of efficiencies and tax breaks, despite Washington rhetoric, it's a program that will likely continue to be utilized in the Triangle and beyond. Wildrick says he understood why Teleflex made the move to Ireland, where the corporate tax rate is 12.5%. They had been moving as much business through Ireland as possible to take advantage of the lower tax rates, he says. Teleflex, the Department of Labor found, was hardly alone. In just the Raleigh metro area, 7 TAA petitions, paperwork citing employers are cutting jobs due to foreign trade impact, such as through offshoring, have been certified by the federal government in the past 2 years. Those numbers include 3 applications approved just last year from IBM, Dimension Data, and CDM Smith, and each TAA petition can involve multiple workers. Even as the North Carolina Department of Commerce successfully lures investments and expansions by firms such as Pendo and Advance Auto Parts, companies are eyeing overseas opportunities. In 2016, for example, the McClatchy Company, which owns the News and Observer, saw 3 of its former employees, all in service and support, file an application alleging services are being outsourced to a foreign country. That application was certified by the federal government later that same year. Other companies, such as Elster, moved its manufacturing to Mexico, displacing Raleigh workers and resulting in another application in 2016. The numbers have stayed consistent across the state. Overall, 31 TAA petitions impacting North Carolina workers were reviewed and decided upon in 2018, compared to just 23 in 2017. Government lends helping hand. While employees themselves can't submit the petition, such as with Wildrick, the majority of the time they are filed by state officials, employers, or even union officials. In North Carolina, the TAA program is often triggered by officials from the North Carolina Department of Commerce responding to a layoff notice. If the petition is certified by the feds, the state jumps into action. That triggers us to reach out to the employer to obtain a spreadsheet of all the workers that are affected with their contact information, explains Diana Rivera, the TAA state coordinator for the North Carolina Department of Commerce. She notes that TAA is considered the Cadillac of workforce programs, as displaced employees can update their certifications, obtain diplomas or degrees. It doesn't have to be a community college. It can be a private vendor, she says. And when the state unemployment benefits run out, TAA kicks in, offering benefits at the same level through the completion of that training program. TAA clients can also get travel reimbursements for job interviews and up to 90% of their relocation expenses, Rivera explains. In the Triangle, a common theme on TAA applications has been jobs being offshored to India. Dimension Data, according to what a California-based TAA specialist wrote in an application, was moving its Tier 2 team to India, impacting an unknown number of workers in the Triangle. Three workers from Thermo Fisher Scientific claimed all services positions, as well as the entire U.S. order entry team stationed in Asheville, have been outsourced to Bangalore, India, although the company is calling it a workforce reduction and job elimination. That's what is alleged to have happened with HCL America, too. A group of its workers saw its TAA application certified in 2016, just 2 years after HCL was approved for an incentives package worth more than $21 million. While officials say HCL has kept its expansion promises in the state, the Indian IT services company pledged in 2014 to bring 1,237 new jobs to Cary. HCL has been taking advantage of efficiencies elsewhere, even as it grows here, records show. And with the talent crunch, it's also been onshoring jobs from India in the Triangle. The company was approved for 755 H-1B visas in fiscal 2018 to fill jobs in Wake and Durham counties. A review of recent TAA petitions shows claims of offshoring to India, Ireland, the Philippines, Mexico, and China over the past 5 years. Lure of offshoring. Despite job growth, offshoring isn't going away, economists say. Robert Scott, a researcher with the Economic Policy Institute, estimates that the offshoring problem is going to get a lot worse in the next few years. He says North Carolina, with its manufacturing prowess, has been among the hardest hit. From 2000 through November, 38% of all North Carolina manufacturing jobs were lost, according to EPI. During that same time period, he says the U.S. lost about 26%. Manufacturing generally has been decimated, especially by trade with China, he says. North Carolina is particularly vulnerable because you had, at least in the beginning of this era, a lot of employment in furniture and textile and apparel. They all got hit very hard. But trade isn't the only factor. With Teleflex, for example, Wildrick and his colleagues told the government in their TAA application in March 2017 that the entire strategic sourcing function has been moved to Athlone, Ireland, and that at least 15 members of their team had been impacted. Scott says it's likely part of a tax game several companies, from soda bottling to software, play, offshoring intellectual property rights and the production of high value-added components simply to avoid high payment of taxes. He says the scenario was supposed to be fixed with President Donald Trump's tax bill in 2017, but the legislation still contains a provision that allowed for lower taxes for offshoring. Taxes earned offshore under the current tax code don't have to be paid until they are repatriated. So companies, large multinational businesses, piled up literally trillions of profits offshore and never brought them home, Scott says. The simple solution for that is to tax production everywhere in the world at the same rate for goods sold in the United States. But we choose not to do that. He says tax cuts coupled with spending increases could increase the U.S. goods trade deficit from more than $800 billion to between $1.2 trillion and $2 trillion by 2020, which will make it even worse for manufacturing, he says. Simulations by the EPI show the deficit could directly eliminate between 2.5 million and 7.5 million U.S. jobs, primarily in manufacturing. The International Monetary Fund is predicting rising imports will drive the current U.S. deficit from $449 billion in 2018 to more than $800 billion in 2022. A perfect storm, Scott predicts, could lead to a new recession. Following the corporate tax cuts, firms returned about $465 billion in repatriated cash in the first half of 2018, according to the Washington Post, but it's just one-sixth of the $3 trillion or more in profits believed to be kept overseas by U.S. companies. Trump has said previously that the tax law would repatriate $4 trillion. Manufacturing close to consumers. Nicole Keating, the director of federal projects at the Tax Foundation, says there are too many factors involved in offshoring decisions to blame taxes alone for offshoring. They're looking at workforce-related issues, where they can find the talent they need, salaries, benefits, all of that, she says. They're looking at factors in terms of the market. That's the case with Cary's Lord Corporation, which has been expanding overseas. In a recent interview, Ed Auslander, CEO of the $1 billion manufacturing firm, said that while the firm has been growing stateside, its global strategy means foreign investments. When we invest in China, it's for the China market, he explains. When we invest in Europe, it's for the European market. Keating says that's a common thread. You want to build your products close to the market, she says. Prior to the tax bill, another factor made the U.S. non-competitive, Keating claims, the corporate income tax rate of 35%, the highest in the industrialized world. In lowering the tax rate to 21%, the U.S. is in line with its trading partners, making the nation more competitive than it was just a few years ago. No hard feelings. Today, Wildrick runs a consulting business in Wake Forest, one that has taken him to China, Taiwan, and Italy, experiences he says he never would have had if it weren't for Teleflex, which he now counts among his customers. Teleflex did not respond for comment. It really did turn out to be the best possible thing for me, he says, though he notes some of his colleagues weren't so lucky. His advice to the displaced? Even without mega projects such as Amazon and Apple, the region is creating jobs, says NC State University economist Mike Walden, but he contends that globalization is too strong to be significantly downsized in our economy. Access to foreign production and foreign labor is one reason why, despite low unemployment and tightness in the U.S. labor market, inflation is not overheating, he says. Future advances in technology, such as virtualization and remote delivery of services like medical care, will only reinforce the global links. For Wildrick, the layoffs were a reality, and he was quick to adapt. It's corporate America, he says. No hard feelings. And there's a shorter companion article along with this article written by Dane Huffman. Worker assistance program dates to Kennedy era. The federal program to support workers who have lost their jobs because the work was sent overseas dates back to the days of President John F. Kennedy. In 1962, Kennedy signed the Trade Expansion Act, which gave the president more tariff-cutting authority, but the act also allowed the federal government to compensate workers who were hurt when they lost their jobs to foreign competitors. In other words, the federal government sought to open up more free trade and to balance that by supporting workers hurt by foreign competition. The program, known as Trade Adjustment Assistance, allows workers who have exhausted their unemployment benefits to get more support, including training, subsidies, and relocation allowances. But the TAA part of the act to support workers was little used until the Trade Act of 1974 eased requirements on eligibility. According to a Congressional Research Service report from August, the number of workers in the program rose from 59,000 in fiscal 1975 to 600,000 by fiscal 1980. TAA continued to be reauthorized through the years, most recently in 2015, when President Barack Obama signed the Trade Adjustment Assistance Reauthorization Act. TAA is administered by the federal government and the states, but funded by the U.S. government. In fiscal 2018, Congress allotted $790 million, $450 million for training, and $340 million for income support for workers in the TAA program. According to a report from the Obama White House, TAA benefited 30,843 North Carolina workers from 2009 through 2015. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. Written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, Kane's Francis joins real estate firm. The Triangle's commercial real estate scene has a new recruit, Ron Francis, who played 23 seasons in the National Hockey League and became general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes, is changing careers. He will join NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty, which Chairman Steve Stroud founded in 1972. It's been a long time since I've been the rookie, Francis quips. Francis, 55, met Stroud through Stroud's role on the Centennial Authority, and they once traveled to Rocky Mount on a naming rights pitch with RBC Bank. They kept in touch and were even investors in Trust Atlantic Financial in 2006. The bank was acquired in 2015. After his playing days ended in 2004, Francis joined the Hurricanes front office and became general manager in 2014. However, new owner Tom Dundon removed him in March. As for hockey, Francis says, I could probably have stayed in the game, but I probably would have had to move. Francis says he and Stroud first began discussing a role in April. I told him, let me take a class and see if I like it, Francis says. So the Hockey Hall of Famer plunged into a real estate class taught on Mondays and Tuesdays. It's been a long time since I went back to school, Francis says. He signed autographs when asked and politely answered a fellow student when she finally asked, who exactly are you? He joins NAI Carolantic just after it lost Moss Withers, who formed his own firm. Ron has a strong history of leadership and deep understanding of teamwork, Stroud says. As a team at NAI Carolantic for more than 45 years, we've driven some of the biggest commercial developments in our area's history. As an investment broker, Ron will help fuel our continued growth and deliver on our promise of world-class service, he says. Francis appreciates the firm's commitment to the market and believes his previous career will help. He had a deft ability to feed teammates the puck, and his 1,249 assists trails only Wayne Gretzky at 1,963 in NHL history. In hockey, a lot of what you do relates to business, Francis says. You learn to be part of a team, work well with others. His hockey career is behind him, but it turns out he isn't out of assists. Investors add more land at Northgate. The new owners of Northgate Mall have added another puzzle piece to their plans for the shopping complex north of downtown Durham with the $1.05 million purchase of a building occupied by Bank of America. The 3,800-square-foot branch sits on a half-acre property in a parking lot southeast of the mall and was one of the few remaining parcels at the mall not controlled by Northwest Investors, a Denver private equity firm that bought Northgate in December for $34.5 million. The firm has been silent on what might be in store for the shopping complex, but the prior owner has alluded to significant plans for an overhaul. Northwood Investors has the resources to make the necessary dramatic changes to the overall development of the property, Virginia Ginny Rand Bowman said in a statement last month after her family closed on the sale of the mall to Northwood. Northwood Investors now owns more than 47 acres at the Northgate site, including the Sears building. Raleigh residents queue up as Asheville Brewery arrives. Who says beer isn't a big business here in the Triangle? On January 5, Asheville's Burial Beer Company opened its bodega-style taproom at the Transfer Company Food Hall in downtown Raleigh. Doors were set to open at 2 p.m., but by noon, the line had already reached around the corner. Burial had a rare and limited release of beers that usually don't see the light outside of its South Slope taproom in Asheville, including I Used to Be an Athlete, To Streak Blood Across My Brow, and the 12% ABV barley wine, The Virtue of Patience. When the doors opened, cases of beer were purchased at the front door, and pints lined up the small bar inside. Co-owners Doug and Jess Reiser made the trip to Raleigh just for the event. As the crowd packed the tiny space, one might wonder if Burial's location might be too small. But that's not the case, according to Doug Reiser, who was inspired by Danny Meyer's Daily Provision in New York City. You stand in line. It's credit card only. You buy your box of Danishes to go. We want to do that with beer, he says. He also explains that the Raleigh location was a given after a visit to State of Beer in Raleigh last year for a beer drop. That was the moment that really spurred the idea that if we did something outside of Asheville, Raleigh was the place. Bandwidth CEO cashes in. With a recent $3.5 million deal, Bandwidth CEO David Morken has made his first big stock sale since the communications software firm he co-founded went public in 2017. Securities filings show Morken exercised derivatives on January 7 to sell more than 100,000 shares valued at $3,535,540. For Morken, who made $1.5 million in 2017, it's the first big stock sell-off reported since the company went public on the NASDAQ at $20. The company's stock rose 75% in 2018, closing at $40.75 on December 31. Morken owned more than 17% of the company as of last year's proxy, an increase from his pre-IPO stake of 12%. Another carrier jumps into the Triangle market. Low-cost Florida carrier Via Airlines is making its Raleigh-Durham International Airport debut in April. The airline announced February 9 that it's planning to launch a nonstop between RDU and Birmingham, Alabama on April 11. The flight will operate on Sundays, Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, and the one-way price to Birmingham varies from $98 to $294, according to Via's website. The carrier, which serves 19 cities across the United States, plans to reach 100 communities by the end of 2020. William Swellbar, an analyst with Delta Airline Services, says to expect additional investment by low-cost carriers at RDU in the coming years. Medium hub airports, they're really the domain of the low-cost carriers, and the ultra-low-cost carriers ultimately will surpass the network carriers in those markets, he says. Already this year, Frontier Airlines has announced 8 new nonstops out of RDU, becoming the airport's largest carrier in terms of destinations. Traditional carriers, however, continue to dominate the market share. Delta Airlines will not go away quietly, Swellbar says. Delta continues to dominate RDU numbers, serving 31% of its boarding passengers, according to RDU's most recent statistics. And finally, in a section called Get Outdoors, New Year's Day hikes rise in popularity across the state. The tradition of participating in guided hikes in North Carolina state parks on New Year's Day began more than 40 years ago at Durham's Eno River State Park. While it took until 2012 for all the state parks to adopt that tradition, what's now known as First Day Hikes has grown even more, and it crossed another milestone January 1. That day, the hikes brought a record 3,859 people to join 57 guided hikes across the state. Hundreds of dogs, two llamas, and a goat joined their human companions on various hikes, and overall, participants ranged in age from newborn to 95. Other traditional events took place, including the Polar Plunge at Hanging Rock. These hikes were a great start to the year for people of all ages, said Dwayne Patterson, director of the state parks. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Banking, Tech, and Startups, written by Lauren Onasorge. Carrie's Lord Corporation soars to $1 billion mark. Thanks in part to a blockbuster Boeing contract, the Triangle has a new billion-dollar company, Cary-based Lord Corporation. The 95-year-old manufacturing firm disclosed the milestone early on January 8, about 10 months after announcing the Boeing deal, which has it developing new cockpit control devices for Boeing's fastest-selling jetliner, the 737 MAX. That contract, Lord's biggest yet, is on track, CEO Ed Auslander says. We should be fully in production in the first half of 2020, he says, noting that the project has already led to other program wins, the perfect cap to a record year for Lord. The contract, coupled with a year of major growth investments, positions Lord for a big 2019, Auslander says. Lord recently broke ground on its Pennsylvania chemical facility expansion, initially targeted as an $80 million investment over 5 years. Auslander says, we've had to accelerate that because of growth. And the board recently approved a major manufacturing investment in Germany, too, this one surrounding the firm's electric vehicle initiative. That, on top of Lord's recent grand opening of a new electromechanical systems facility in France. Auslander says the future is bright for Lord, particularly as the electric vehicle space expands. Lord provides thermal management materials and adhesives for power inverters, motor and battery packs in the electric vehicle industry, and recently won a lot of new programs that will launch into production later this year and through 2020, he says. That's in addition to its work in traditional vehicles. We're a very big automotive player, he says. We have specialty adhesive on just about every car in the world. Lord Corporation has about 3,000 employees across the globe. Startup taps Union Station for HQ. The first tenant of Raleigh's Union Station could be a startup. A year and a half after appearing on Shark Tank, Raleigh-based paint and sip startup Wine and Design has targeted the new building for its headquarters. The startup, headed by Harriet Mills, has reached a deal with the city to lease the upper mezzanine of the downtown train station, coming to about 2,700 square feet. She declined to give further details. "We're really excited to be a part of the growing downtown area," Mills says, adding that the proximity to travelers could help grow the brand. The goal is to get travelers to put down their technology and paint and actually enjoy the city, she adds. Dogwood's plan, acquire Coastal Bank, then grow. Less than 2 months after withdrawing its startup application, the team behind Dogwood State Bank has a new plan to create a Raleigh-headquartered statewide financial institution, take over management of a coastal entity similar to what investors did with Vantage South about a decade ago. Steve Jones, who hopes to be the CEO of Dogwood, confirms his team has reached an agreement to take over management of Morehead City-based Sound Bank. "And we plan to recapitalize, rebrand, and move the headquarters from Morehead City to Raleigh," he says, noting the new bank will operate under the Dogwood name and brand, just as planned in his initial de novo application. "It just made sense for what we were trying to do on a de novo basis to start out with some scale and some really good deposits," he says of the Sound deal. "It was just the right time and the right place." Cree announces $250 million deal. For the third time in a year, Cree's power and radio frequency device subsidiary, Wolfspeed, has made a multi-million dollar agreement. This time, it's a $250 million mega deal to produce and supply silicon carbide wafers to global semiconductor company ST Microelectronics. "This deal is bigger than all of Wolfspeed was just a year ago," Cree CEO Greg Lowe said January 7. "It's actually astounding that one deal can be so large." All of the material at play in the deal is manufactured in the Triangle. Lowe didn't say specifically the contract would lead to more jobs, but did note a correlation between the growth and mega manufacturing deals. The Wolfspeed unit has been growing in headcount and in revenue since Lowe announced future projections in February that its revenue would increase from what was then just over $200 million to $850 million by 2022. And finally, Live Oak seeks fintech startups for investment. Live Oak Bank's venture arm is looking for deals targeting platform technologies and, unlike the big venture capital guns, aiming squarely at early stage startups. That's according to Timur Davis, principal at Live Oak Ventures, speaking after the Wilmington Bank disclosed a minority stake investment in Quipt, a Wilmington business-to-business equipment rental and leasing marketplace platform. "We're always looking for companies building next-generation platforms and developing really innovative software that's disrupting market segments that are not really well-developed," he explains. With Quipt, the renting and leasing market is ripe for disruption, Davis says. Live Oak is looking at innovative software companies, particularly fintech. It's specifically interested in open APIs, application programming interfaces, rather than closed ecosystems. "That's just the direction we feel the trend is going," he says. "We tend to invest quite early," Davis adds. "We think that investing in earlier stage companies allows for a closer relationship and the opportunity to more deeply collaborate. The biggest point a company must show Live Oak is differentiation. If there are five or six startups that are doing essentially the same thing, it's really hard to choose," he says. "One of those might become very successful, but at least for me, it's sometimes pretty hard when a particular segment is exasperated. We're really looking for disruptive types of companies that are targeting areas that have become kind of archaic." Now we turn to the On Real Estate section, written by Ben Graham. Project viewed as spark for Southeast Raleigh. The development firm that bought the 515-acre Old Town site in Southeast Raleigh closed on the property in 21 days without getting approval of development plans or construction documents beforehand. Brokers have described the acquisition as speculative, but for Maryland-based Hale Companies. The property's location was enough to commit $10.5 million to the land purchase in December without completing the due diligence typically done for large land deals. When you're 10 minutes from downtown Raleigh and you have 500 acres, there's really not much else you can say about that because you won't find anything that large that close, Hale Company's project manager Eric Rifkin says. For Raleigh City Councilman Corey Branch, the appeal is slightly different. Branch represents the city's District C, which covers much of southeast Raleigh, an area that Branch says could use an injection of new development from new homes to places to shop. There's some areas in Raleigh where you can drive half a mile and pass five grocery stores, Branch says. Here you could drive 5 miles and you might pass two. Old Town could bring a grocery store and much more. Current zoning allows up to 1,700 housing units. Before the Great Recession, Old Town was similarly viewed as a project that could revitalize a large swath of southeast Raleigh, but the project fell victim to the economic downturn and sold in foreclosure. Hale Companies bought the property after the prior owner, PNC Bank, got a zoning rule changed in September that would have required a golf course to be built on the property. Rifkin estimates adding the fairways and clubhouses would have cost $12 million to $15 million while bringing in little additional revenue. Let's just say it was cash flow nothing, he says. With the golf course requirement gone, Rifkin says the firm plans to begin the development process by surveying the land and figuring out what infrastructure was installed by prior owners. The firm also is already working on another rezoning request and plans to ask City Council to allow 300 of the housing units on the property to be in the form of apartments. Triangle's first Wegmans looks to hire 475 people, open in the fall. Wegmans has begun the process of finding 475 employees to staff the grocery chain's new location on Wake Forest Road in Raleigh, expected to open in the fall. The store, part of Wegmans' growing footprint in the southeast, is one of five being planned in the Triangle and is on track to be the first to open, according to an announcement from the company. Of the new jobs, 150 will be full-time with a majority will be local hires, according to the company. The grocery store will total 104,000 square feet and anchor the larger Midtown East Shopping Center, being built by Regency Centers. Other tenants at the complex include Salon del Sol, Bella Lifestyle, Club Pilates, Maple Street Biscuit, and Cava, a Mediterranean quick-serve restaurant out of Washington, D.C. The mixed-use development is scheduled to open next summer. As construction is ramped up, development on adjacent properties has gained steam. In November, Loden Properties and Summit Hospitality Group bought a parcel for $3.15 million for a six-story Hampton Inn and Suites, expected to open in early 2020. The Wegmans will feature a restaurant chain called the Burger Bar, serving up burgers, salads, and sandwiches, in addition to beer and wine by the glass. Portfolio spanning from Raleigh to Charlotte sells for $169 million. A Chicago real estate investment firm has closed on a sizable apartment portfolio acquisition that includes 1,148 units spread throughout four complexes in Raleigh, Charlotte, and Cary, and is planning upgrades that would lead to higher rents and more returns in the near future. Waterton, which also provides property management services, bought the multifamily properties for a combined $169 million from an investment group led by the Bainbridge Companies. The complexes were built in the 1980s and 1990s and include Atria at Crabtree Valley in Raleigh, Audubon Park in Cary, and Ashford Green and the Retreat at McAlpine Creek, both in Charlotte. Waterton plans to pump between $20 million and $30 million into renovations, replacing countertops and plumbing fixtures, while improving clubhouses with new gym equipment and other upgrades. Sustained job growth and migration to the Triangle and Charlotte made the complexes attractive as investments, says Matt Masender, Waterton Senior Vice President of Acquisitions. Those are really the demand drivers that drive our business, us and our competitors, he says. Former Rathskeller space in Chapel Hill lands new tenant. After years of sitting empty, the once beloved Ram's Head Rathskeller restaurant in a Franklin Street alley in Chapel Hill will soon be home to a Raleigh brewery looking to show off its expansive beer list. Gizmo Brew Works is planning a 4,500 square foot tap room in the basement that was home to the Rathskeller since the 1940s. Gizmo co-owner Brian Williams says there is no firm opening date yet, but is aiming for May. Renovations will take place throughout the winter and spring, transforming the subterranean room into a bar with 50 taps. Our plan is to produce a large variety of beer and to try to do it all with our own beers, he says. That shouldn't be too difficult for the brewery, which pumped out about 50 brews last year. Still, to cut down on potential lines at the bar, Gizmo will dedicate 2 taps apiece to a single beer. We want to make sure there's not a long wait at the bar, William says. We have game days in mind. The Gizmo team has been looking for tap room and warehouse space for more than a year. The initial search took them to downtown Raleigh, but William says finding a shop front was proving competitive and expensive. After 4 years, apartment complex sells near RTP sells. An Illinois multifamily investor has cashed out on an apartment investment in Mooresville, bringing in $8.6 million in 4 years. Sherman Residential closed on the $47.8 million sale of the Southern Oaks at Davis Park complex at the end of 2018, selling the 287-unit property to Cortland of Atlanta. The complex was built in 2007 and previously belonged to PGIM Real Estate, formerly known as Prudential Real Estate Investors, which sold the complex to Sherman Residential at the end of 2014 for $39.2 million. Now we turn to On Life Sciences and Education, written by Seth Gulledge. Fujifilm to add 100 jobs at RTP campus. Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies Research Triangle Park-based manufacturing facilities will take center stage in the company's recently announced $90 million expansion and see about half the funding come to the triangle. The company recently announced the expansion of its bio contract development and manufacturing business with a heavy focus on its existing RTP manufacturing facilities. Martin Meeson, president and chief operating officer, who oversees the company's RTP and Texas facilities, confirmed about half the investment will be used for the expansion of its triangle facilities, including the addition of single-use cell culture manufacturing trains, cell culture purification suites, and new microbial recovery suites. The company plans to increase its cell culture manufacturing capacity by approximately 25% and microbial capacity by approximately 50% at the location to meet existing demand. We're really excited, he says. We've been here for several years on site, and it's nice to see the business coming through and our need to expand to keep up with that business. Meeson says the investment is expected to bring about 100 jobs to the area, bringing its local headcount to about 580. The expansions are expected to be operational by 2020. Further investments are planned at the company's other locations, and more details on all projects are expected to be announced in first quarter 2019. Duke University professors lead in statewide salary survey. Faculty at Triangle Universities are some of the best paid in the state, with local universities topping the list of average salaries for instructional staff. The data for the ranking of the 25 largest universities in North Carolina comes from the National Center for Education Statistics, which annually reports the average salaries of full-time instructional staff equated to 9 months worked. The averages do not include salaries of medical staff. The greatest factors in compensation are the instructional staff's position and time at the university, as well as fields of expertise. Lecturers are paid the least on average, and professors are paid the most. Lecturers at Duke University, NC State University, and UNC Chapel Hill are paid, on average, between $52,366 to $57,282. Professors received between $126,602 to $194,531, with Duke professors on the high end. Male and female instructional staff salaries differ 33% at Duke, 24% at UNC, and 18% at NC State, with males being paid more than their female colleagues on average, according to the data. However, university officials say a more detailed peer-to-peer comparison shows that those differences are not based on gender. Michael Schoenfeld, Duke's Vice President of Public Affairs and Government Relations, says the school pays close attention to compensation. When you control for obvious factors that affect compensation, such as market rates and disciplines, the rank of the individual, tenured full professor versus new assistant professor, for example, and length of service, there is no meaningful difference between the compensation for male and female faculty at Duke, he says. Firm scores $3.7 million for product that can be used with cannabis oil. Triangle-grown Altopa has another $3.7 million in the pot, which it plans to use to launch the commercialization of its O-Blend device. The company recently announced the closing of a $3.7 million fundraising round in which 30 investors participated. Those dollars are on top of $1.4 million it raised in 2016. Nicole Wicker, co-founder and CEO, says the funding provides the capital to launch the commercial product and become cash positive. O-Blend is a countertop botanical oil mixing device that allows users to develop their own shampoos, vitamins, perfumes, and even cannabis oil, provided it's legal where you are. The device comes with a smartphone app that will collect information from users, data that could help if the company explores a medical application with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Start date of Wake Tech's new president moved up. Scott Rawls will be returning to the Triangle to run Wake Tech Community College a little bit sooner than planned. On January 7, the Wake Tech Board of Trustees approved a transition plan that has Rawls starting April 12 as the fourth president of the system, bumping up his original start date by 19 days. The plan also adopts a change in leadership to accommodate the late January departure of interim president Bill Aiken. Rawls, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate, served as head of North Carolina Community Colleges from 2008 to 2015. Prior to that, he served as president of Craven Community College in New Bern. He is now president of Northern Virginia Community College. In December, the board selected Rawls from a list of three finalists. He succeeds Stephen Scott, who served 15 years before retiring in August. And finally, GeneCentric founder shifts role in leadership shuffle. Research Triangle Park's GeneCentric is changing its leadership lineup. Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman, the founder and current president and CEO of the cancer drug company, will take the new role of executive chairwoman and succeed Clay Thorpe, a founder and general partner at Hatteras Venture Partners. Michael Milburn will replace Leigh Goldman. Leigh Goldman also serves on the board of directors at West Pharmaceutical Services and Cuvella Corporation and is a venture partner with Hatteras. Michael brings a broad range of expertise that spans drug development, biomarker discovery and diagnostic development, and commercialization, along with a strong track record of commercial execution that built significant value, Thorpe said. We look forward to his new leadership role at GeneCentric. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. Nonprofits optimistic about GivingTotals, this article written by Seth Gulledge. The beginning of last year had nonprofits worried that the sweeping tax overhauls from December 2017 might stem charitable donations, and 2019 has politicians, businessmen, and charities alike watching the economy and wondering if it's in store for a decline. Triangle nonprofits say this newest development has them less concerned, as the last year both positioned their strategy to insulate themselves from donor decline and demonstrated that enough donors seemed to keep giving regardless. Amy Barros, Vice President of Development for the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, says her organization is funded almost 60% by individual donors. Of that revenue, about 40% is collected during the holiday season, meaning the organization had plenty to think about when it began its budgeting in March. Last year, during our budgeting time, we were concerned and we did really analyze what year-end giving would look like, she says. We have fortunately not seen any impact of it this year. Still, the organization is being conservative in budgeting this year. Westray VC, an attorney with the Trust Company of the South in Raleigh, says her firm's clients, who generally have upward of $5 million in investable assets, continued giving and probably will continue to do so. In general, wealthy individuals make charitable gifts, she says. A tax deduction is a benefit, but not the primary motivator. VC notes that the firm's clients did change the way they are giving, such as timing their donations and methods of giving to maximize the benefits. These methods include front-loading their planned gifts into donor-advised funds or bunching years of planned gifts in 1 year to take advantage of the changes. By bunching gifts into a single year, a wealthy donor can better take advantage of changes such as the new standard deduction for married couples of $24,000. VC also says a vibrant economy helped giving in 2018. Many nonprofits are still tallying giving from 2018. The V Foundation for Cancer Research, for example, does not have final numbers yet. And whether 2019 leads to strong giving overall is anyone's guess, but nonprofits say they are being careful. As far as markets, we don't really look at that when we're making budgets. We would be in pretty consistent chaos if we were analyzing and making our decisions off of that, Barrow says. I would say we do always look at our expenses and our revenue conservatively each year because we have to be stable for our communities and we have to be able to provide the needed resources. Nonprofits say a sliding economy's worst effect could come not from private donor reluctance, but from slashed government appropriations. Heather Strickland, who oversees donor relations for the North Carolina Partnership for Children, says their organization, which relies primarily on appropriations, has spent the last few years developing a strategy to bring in private donations to pad against any drop in government giving. Prior to 2011, when the company fell out, we had not done a ton of private fundraising, she says. When it fell out and our public funding started to get cut, that's when we actually started to shift focus and say we've got to start increasing the private in public-private partnership. Since 2018, Strickland says the organization to working to create a collaborative fundraising network for their various partners. With any luck, she says, through increasing these private dollars and establishing other ways to support their work helping children throughout the state. It won't matter much what the economy or tax laws look like, just what needs need to be addressed. And also we have the nonprofit notes. Raleigh Center seeks to add access to health care. A Raleigh nonprofit health clinic will see patients for as little as $20 as it helps address gaps in health care. We are really trying to improve access for folks in Wake County, says Sue Ellen Thompson, executive director of the Neighborhood Health Center. We're seeing people who have Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance, or no insurance at all, and we have a sliding fee scale based on their income. The clinic, which opened in June, serves about 20 people per day with a staff of about 10 that includes a physician and physician's assistant. Funding came from private donors, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Foundation, and $500,000 from the state. The goal is to let people know they have a medical home, Thompson says. Big galas ahead. The Triangle is full of galas that raise money for worthy causes, and a couple of major ones are coming up. A Winter's Tale, the annual fundraiser for the Methodist Home for Children, is February 2 at the Raleigh Convention Center. The speaker is author Steve Pemberton, who grew up in difficult circumstances in foster care in Massachusetts. Tickets start at $150. In 2018, the gala drew more than 500 people and raised $330,000 at the convention center. Also at the convention center will be the Triangle Heart Ball, which benefits the American Heart Association. The Heart Ball will be March 1 with a reception at 6 p.m. and dinner at 8 p.m. Now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Shutdown's Effect Flows Through IPO Ecosystem. In the first 8 days of 2019, there has been zero approvals of initial public offerings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Not because companies are not eager to file, but because the SEC is prohibited from approving new and existing corporate registration statements during the partial government shutdown. Given the economic landscape and the chatter about a slowing economy getting louder, corporate dealmakers and lawyers have been advising companies to file the IPO documents as early as possible to get out before Wall Street changes its mood. Now everything is halted and the capital ecosystem, from seed capital to IPO cashouts, is in need of a reboot, albeit for the short term. For companies in the triangle, the flow of dollars through seed rounds and offering an exit strategy for investors through an IPO pretty much makes up our entrepreneurial culture. DealLogic, a company that specializes in the IPO market, notes that since 1995, there has been an IPO drought in January only three times, 2003, 2009, and 2016. If the SEC is not allowed to do its job, 2019 will be the fourth year. Because of the volatility in the stock market, especially in the fourth quarter of 2018, the first quarter 2019 was being viewed as a big window for companies to go through the public markets. If January is gone, there's going to be a logjam when the SEC gets back to work. It likely will delay the timeline of several registrations, including disclosures from smaller companies in early rounds of financing. But here's the problem. Capital markets may give a totally separate vibe in the second quarter, making it tough for bankers and institutional investors to come to an agreement about pricing of a stock and the overall valuation. Companies such as Uber Technologies and Lyft can absorb the valuation squeeze by waiting for a few quarters, but the same cannot be said for smaller biotechs and life sciences companies that need the money to continue the development of a drug and the costly approval process from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Perhaps the partial shutdown by itself would not have had a meaningful impact on the capital markets had it not been for the timing of our economic cycle. For the most part, our economy is still going strong, as evidenced by the December job growth numbers released a few days ago. But for entrepreneurs and investors looking to roll and reinvest money into the entrepreneurial cycle, this delay from the federal government could complicate things in the coming quarters. A 2015 Congressional Research Service report estimated that the U.S. gross domestic product, GDP, growth is cut by 0.1% for every week of the government shutdown. You do the math. Now we'll turn to a section called Family Business, where we'll read James Lee's column. He is a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, How to Add Some Spark to the Gray Days of January. With the holidays behind us and the new year settling in, we're in the throes of what many families in business view as the gray days of early January. Those families are spending the first few weeks after Christmas looking over the less than spectacular revenue of 2018 and gearing up for inventory reduction sales. They're scrambling to be sure everything is in order for tax reporting and trying to guess what the year ahead will look like. To add to the spirit of the season, January in much of the United States is a month of gray days. And since you'll probably spend most of it indoors staring at spreadsheets and thinking somber thoughts, here are a few ways to make good use of the time. Use these days for strategic thinking about the rest of the year. Plot your company's activity month by month right through 2019. Fill out the company calendar in as much detail as possible to avoid being blindsided by unforeseen needs and events. This month is also a good time for service companies and professional firms to consider the demands and opportunities of seasonal changes. January is also a chance for reorganizing the work environment. Clean out the files, dump obsolete inventory, redesign your office layout to improve the efficiency and comfort of how employees relate to one another, clean the rubbish out of your workspace and your administrative systems that made handling the demands of this holiday's business so much more difficult than it had to be. You can also use January to schedule this year's meetings of the Family Council or Advisory Board that links the business and family interests. It's smart to get them on everyone's calendars as soon as possible. Make attendance attractive this year by planning to hold those meetings somewhere more interesting than a conference room. If every problem is an opportunity, then every gray January day can be a garden of creative thinking about how to strengthen your family business in 2019. Set the spreadsheets aside, turn up the light and the heat in the office, and work on both the small details and the larger objectives. Spend these days taking a long look at the rest of the year's possibilities for improving your business's performance, profitability, and satisfaction. And in news around the state, Movement Mortgage adds $1.5 billion in loan volume with BUY. Indian land-based Movement Mortgage announced January 9 it plans to acquire Eagle Home Mortgage LLC, adding 35 new locations in the Pacific Northwest and Mountain West regions. The deal would add about $1.5 billion to Movement's annual mortgage loan originating volume, the company says. Movement declined to give a purchase price. The acquisition is expected to close by the end of this month. We want to grow, and we relentlessly look for purpose-filled, growth-minded mortgage professionals who want to make a meaningful difference in their industry and communities, says Casey Crawford, chief executive at Movement. About 230 mortgage employees from Eagle Home will be joining Movement as part of the acquisition. Movement already has approximately 1,500 loan officers and a network of more than 650 branches. Eagle Home Mortgage is a subsidiary of Miami-based Lennar Corporation. Eagle Home was recently fined $13.2 million by the U.S. Department of Justice for its faulty lending practices between January 1, 2006 and December 31, 2011, during which time the company submitted insurance requests to the Federal Housing Administration for loans that did not qualify. DOJ determined those actions were in violation of the False Claims Act, which protects government programs from fraud. The deal will likely offer some relief from Movement's recent struggles with lower-than-expected loan volumes. In 2018, Movement laid off about 350 employees in three separate waves, each time citing a tough mortgage market as the reason for it. A spokesperson for the company says the contracting mortgage market in the U.S. led to new business opportunities. And finally, we'll take a quick look at the Business Survey Pulse. The question, do you plan to switch jobs in 2019? Number of responses, 52. 60% said yes. 40% say no. And we're going to go ahead and stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.